You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
Time we've ever spoken with someone from the incredible archival department in Aotearoa, Ngā Taonga. We're here with Paul Meredith from Ngā Taonga. We're going to be talking about Te Ihi, Te Mana, Te Tapu, Maringarā, the 50th anniversary of the Māori Land March, which happened in 1975. That's where we have big names like Fina Cooper emerge in a national sort of huge way. I want to thank you for your time and coming on here, Paul. How is your morning going?
Yeah, not bad. I've just been looking at some archival footage that we've recently preserved. We were lucky to get funding from this government, the previous government, to preserve 75% of our collection, which a lot of it was on magnetic media, so cassette tape, VHS, and of course that's all at risk. A lot of the equipment you can't buy these days, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all been preserved for future generations. So amazing footage from the 70s and 80s. You think of programs like Spot On, you know, Top Down, Radio of Pictures, Ready to Roll, Gloss, you know, amazing to have that material now preserved for future generations.
For sure. What happens to the original material once you've archived it and put it on a digital thing? Do you dump it somewhere?
Yeah, no, you hold on to it. You know, technology changes so much, you know, and who knows what you can do and, you know, in the future. So we've still hold on to nitrate film, and I've looked at some material on nitrate film that was preserved in 2006. And then again, and then 2020, and just the quality, the difference, you know, in the quality, just through new technology. So you never know. So, you know, we'll put up, pack it all up, and just be holding on to it. But, you know, it would be just packed away, not necessarily accessed. Mm. And we'll be using the digital material to provide access at some point in time.
You know, I think it makes a lot of sense to turn physical material into digital material, but also with like things like new broadcasts, new news broadcasts, it might be wise to also make them into a physical material in case of, you know, an electromagnetic pulse from the sun or some kind of big war that turns all digital technology useless. I mean, have you thought about doing vice versa?
Yeah, well, that's not my expertise, so I don't probably want to comment on that, but I do hear that, you know, cassettes are making a bit of a comeback. They're quite popular, you know, and I also understand a number of film producers like actually, you know, producing it on, you know, in a physical format as well as born digital. Not my expertise. We've got a lot of technical people that can comment on that, but yeah, I'll raise them with them.
Please do. Now, for the 50th anniversary of the Land March, Ngā Taonga have made a very comprehensive article on their blog page about the causes of the march. They also show extensive documentation of the march itself. There's some really stunning old radio and television clips with Fina Cooper and other associated members of that movement. Is it quite a task converting these old recordings into digital media? You know, are all these old archival bits of media, are they very well organised, or do you have to really fossick around and dig them out?
No, I mean, we're fortunate. It's pretty well organised. We inherited the sound archive from Radio New Zealand and also from Television New Zealand and all their databases. So it's pretty well organised, and we can do better, and we're working to do better, but... yeah, so I mean, we're just lucky to have this this mass digitalization project. If we were trying to do that in house, it'll take us years. I mean, we're talking about a 200-year backlog. So we worked with a company called Memnon, and they literally have stacks of, you know, VHS players and, you know, and other machinery to just running. You know, we're running 24/7 over several years. It comes to an end. This November, their project, and you know, I think they've probably done more than 75% of the collection. So it's just, you know, amazing collection to have now in digital format, and which will in time make it more accessible to New Zealanders.
You continue.
No, it's just like, you know, family members might want to watch. And sometimes we get requests for, you know, want to watch my dad win a car on sale of the century. You know, we talk about that there's well-being and nostalgia. You know, and taking people down trips down memory lane, you know, back to their childhood. So yeah, it's quite a special thing to be able to share that with of the communities, various communities and individuals.
It really is. I was watching some of the old Radio with Pictures episodes that are available on NZ On Screen recently, and it's just so awesome to be able to find old bands that you can't find on the internet because they were at a point in time and they have not been digitized. So one clip of them playing at a concert in Christchurch or in Wellington, that might be all you'll ever see of them, but they made some great music.
Yeah, New Zealand On Screen are great, and we're looking to work with them more. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I did have a question about. Oh yeah, so with the amount of stuff that's, I guess, recorded from the 70s, from this era, I mean, was there a government policy to record all radio interviews and all TV broadcasts? I mean, why is there such an extensive archive?
No, well, I think, because. Yeah, if you watch Breakfast and if you watch programs like The Cutter, they reach back into the archives. So, yeah, for most of it was just kept as a record of New Zealand's audio visual heritage. So, I'm not quite sure if there was any sort of specific policy. It was part of the legislation. And then we work with Te Māngai Pāho, which is the which funds Māori productions, and they have a remit to actually ensure that this material is organised. Archive, so mm-hmm. I'm sure that was the same for Radio New Zealand and Television News and as state broadcasters.
Mm. As well as New Zealand On Air, I imagine.
Yeah.
Now, there seems to... I want to move and talk about the actual landmark itself. There seems to have been a very acute awareness among Māori in the 70s that if... You know, if their kaumātua, their elders, died before they could pass on their knowledge of reo, whakapapa, tikanga, their history, so on and so forth, then the next generation would be in a much worse place. How did that factor into, I guess, the movement with the emergence of younger activist groups like Ngā Tamatoa coming onto the scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's great to be able to watch all this footage and you sort of get a sense of that history. I mean, if you look at that period of time, it's the 70s, there's the whole international movement around civil rights up in America, the Vietnam War. And back home here in New Zealand, you're having the results of urbanisation, which has started, in effect, really, well, before World War II, but, increased rapidly post World War II. Mm-hmm. So you have the effects of that of a new generation sort of disconnected from their land, disconnected from culture. It's also a period of time because you've got television, of course, and a lot of these issues have been beamed into people's homes. And so you look at that period, we just got the 50 years of this week we're celebrating 50 years of the Māori Language Week. So you sort of had the Māori language petition. You had groups like Ngā Tamatoa emerging from the cities, the Te Reo Māori Society, adamant about the loss of the Māori language. So it's all this sort of all these things sort of coming together. You had the 67 Māori Affairs Amendment Act that sort of where the uneconomical land could be taken by the Māori trustees and sold. So it was sort of seen as the last sort of Māori land grab, from 66 million acres. And there was talk about only 3 million acres left in Māori hands. So they're all coming together. This land march, the catch cry was not one more acre. So it wasn't so much about, give us back the land that was taken. It was more about let's not lose one more acre. Let's hold on to, let's hold on to what they had.
Yeah, it was funny listening to an interview with Fina Cooper from the article that you all posted, and she was very clear about that.
amazing woman, if you're looking at it, she was like 79, 75, she was someone who had worked with Sāpira Ngāti around land development schemes up north. Mm. She was the first president of the Māori Women's Welfare League, and it was 1951. So, a very very special a woman, special leader, and to be able to bring all those people together, and it was actually really well organized. You watch this footage, there are different committees with different things, They marched, but there was also, they sent people ahead to plan it all and to work with the various Māori that were going to stay. So very well organized. And, and you could see she was right at the helm.
She was. There's a great clip of her at a meeting just talking about just getting all these, you know, you get this finance report done, you go and liaise with so on and so forth, you get this other report done. Like, it was quite, it was like a very well-oiled machine. You mentioned before that she was 79 at the time of the land march, which is very true. She walked from the tip of the North Island at that age. Very remarkable thing to do. How did she have so much determination and drive to see that through? And what other qualities do you think made her the leader that she's kind of renowned for being in the, I guess, the Aotearoa mythos?
Yeah, I mean, such determination. I mean, someone who had such a wealth of experience, you know, all those years, of, you know, and had been at the leadership helms, you know, from a very young age, I think, you know. I sort of wonder, you know, in today's age, you know, we've got a lot of young people now have the language. It's amazing, beautiful language, but not necessarily the life experience. And she had it all, and she brought that to the fore. I mean, you know, I think at that time there were some that supported, some that didn't. There was, and it was definitely that young element, you know, the more activist, and then there was the more conservative. Mm-hmm. And she was, I think, also a bridge between those two spaces. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though, you know, when they got to Wellington, you know, she then wanted to, you know, let parliamentary follow its process. There was another group that said, no, we want a statement from the, you know, from the government now that they, we're not going to allow one more acre to be, you know, taken. And of course, you know, they stay on and set up a tent embassy at Parliament there, and she goes home, and I understand she was not happy about that. But, you know, so those were all those different complexities. But yeah, just an amazing woman. I think there was a This Is Your Life that was a program that was produced about her, and that's, that might be on New Zealand on screen or on YouTube, but that's definitely a great watch too. I remember that as a kid.
Mm-hmm. I have to have a look at that. I do want to know, you mentioned before just about the sort of, I mean, yeah, the group who stayed behind after the land march to just, you know, protest on Parliament grounds and get more assurances from the government. What happened to all the different political groups who formed, I guess, the vanguard of the land march movement? Because it seems like it was kind of, they kind of just fizzled out afterwards and it got a little bit infighty.
Yeah, they carried on. And of course, you know, if you go to, there's actually another great program about the land march called, that was produced in 2015. By Spotty Productions, and it's on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And it looks at the whole history of the march, and it interviews a lot of those who were participants. And so they also participated on things like Bastion Point, and the whole the occupation there. They were there at the Raglan golf course protest. So, you know, they again, other sort of watershed moments. So yeah, so through the 70s they were definitely still active.
Sure, but as a kind of united front, they kind of weren't really they kind of fell apart a little bit.
Well, there was just different co-pupper and different
Now the urbanization of Māori, I guess, kind of around the World War II time period, it really, you know, it brought two worlds kind of into conflux, you know, the Pākehā world and the Māori world. When the land march happened, did Pākehā New Zealand really understand the issues that Māori were protesting about?
Well, I mean, if you talk to a lot of Pākehā from that time, you know, a lot of them didn't have a lot of interaction with Māori. You know, they had a policy of, you know, in the 60s of trying to pepper potter Māori in the urban centres, so that they weren't getting sort of congregated into one area. But then eventually, you know, you create communities in South Auckland and Porirua. So there was sort of, there's still a little bit of distance, but, you know, but this actually, I think, with television, you know, brought, you know, images into their homes, you know, in the 70s. So I think that's quite a moment. And so, yeah, suddenly they were confronted with it. And I think, you know, there was always been Māori protests throughout the 20th century. But I think it was a lot more, well, you know, it got quite active in the 70s, and it's also in the context of, you know, in, you know, the Vietnam War, you know, civil rights, and so all, you know, it's all that being beamed into people's homes.
It's a global movement.
Yeah, it's a part of that global movement.
What did When they were marching down from the tip of the North Island to Pōneke, Wellington, did the protesters face much resistance, or was it pretty relaxed and pretty easygoing?
I'm sure they would have faced a little bit of resistance, but a lot of support for them also. You know, I was watching the other documentary, you know, and at Moirua, you know, the freezing works there, you know, they were told they weren't to go out and support them, and so they all walked out. Mm. And they, you know, collect them all, you know. And as they got to different towns, you know, people would come and, you know, join. And, you know, people do talk about, you know, asking to take leave. Yes, weren't given leave, so they just went on it and, of course, lost their jobs. So I'm sure, you know, they would have, you know, been privately behind the scenes with a lot of resistance. But then you also see, you know, I was watching some photos last week and a lovely old Pākehā woman waving out, you know, to them. But, you know, definitely as they went through the towns, you know, people would come and, join them, join that march. When I came to Kiriki, there's my father's European. We're from a little town called Kiriki. Mm-hmm. And they stopped there at the memorial there for Uriwe Maniapoto, was a great chief from my tribe, Ngāti Maniapoto. Mm-hmm. And there's this image of a Pākehā man carrying a young boy. And my auntie told me, oh, that's your father. And of course, I thought, oh, that was me. But, oh, great, I was part of the march. So I rang my mother up and I said, oh, and she goes, oh, no. She said, you were sick that day, so I stayed home with you and your father and your brother went up. So I was hugely disappointed. But the rest of all of our family were up there at the memorial to welcome the march.
Oh, that's so awesome. I mean, speaking of kids at the march, in addition to the blog post on the Ngā Taonga website, there's also a conversation with Fina Cooper's granddaughter, which is quite enlightening.
Yes, what a privilege to have for us to be able to interview Irene Cooper, who was the, you know, there's that iconic image when, you know, that 50 marches led by Fina Cooper and holding the hand of her 3-year-old granddaughter, and that's Irene Cooper. And so, yeah, well, it was great to be able to interview her and get her support for this kaupapa. It's a great read. And also, of course, Jeff Stevens, who was, you know, who filmed a lot of that footage. There's also some reflections from him on the blog. And so that was also a privilege.
Mm. Fantastic stuff. It's a great way to celebrate the momentous protest from 1975, the Land March protest, which I think changed a lot about our society, and we're still feeling the impacts of it today. And I want to thank you for coming on the program. Paul, do you have any final words for our lovely listeners?
I should say that this blog was actually mostly produced by one of our newest staff, Lady Pōkō, from, what a great name, isn't it? Lady Pōkō from Ngāti Porou. So she did, she pulled this mostly together. It was her first blog, and I just think she's done a fantastic job.
Mm. Not
so encourage everybody to have a look at it. Encourage everyone to go onto our website and have a look.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on the program today, Paul. I really appreciate your time. I hope you have an excellent rest of your week, my friend.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. All right, folks, that was Paul Meredith from Ngā Taonga. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Māori Land March, which you can find on the Ngā Taonga website. It's called Te Ihi, Te Mana, Te Tapu, Maranga Rā. Here is Christoph Eltra.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.